So the archaeology of the Bible is a massive topic. There's no way that I could sufficiently cover the whole Bible in this time that we have. And so I thought, what is a good time period that really connects to both the Old and New Testaments throughout? And what is also something that's central to the scriptures themselves, and yet is also controversial, something that we really need to study and look into the evidence for? Other than Jesus and the Gospels, I think the Exodus story is one of the most foundational for the entire scriptures, as it does connect throughout. In fact, the various books of the Bible recount sections of the Exodus story as history, sometimes as theological lessons, others practical lessons, other times illustrations. And yet, most scholars today would say that the Exodus never happened, and that this story, or that the book of Exodus, is just a legend or a myth. Some might concede that there are a few historical kernels of truth in there, but by and large, not historical. Here are a couple of archaeologists who give their opinions on the Exodus. William Deaver says, "Not only is there no archaeological evidence for such an Exodus, there is no need to posit such an event. I regard the historicity of the Exodus as a dead issue." Zev Herzog says, "The Israelites were never in Egypt, did not wander in the desert. The many Egyptian documents that we have make no mention of the Israelites' presence in Egypt, and are also silent about the events of the Exodus." So look at those claims that they make. Herzog talks about no mention of Israelite presence in Egypt, complete silence about events of the Exodus. So essentially, there's no evidence they were there or those things happened. And Deaver says, it's a dead issue. That is, we don't even need to look into it anymore because we've already found out or decided it didn't happen. And really, it's ignored throughout most of scholarship. It is considered a dead issue. You saw some information about biblical manuscripts earlier, in particular the New Testament. Of course, the Old Testament also has its own ancient biblical manuscripts. The most important of those are the Dead Sea Scrolls. And one of the oldest Dead Sea Scrolls does, in fact, have Exodus on it. This is called 4Q Exodus F. It's from about the 3rd century BC. So it is quite old, and yet if we look at the time of Moses, we notice that it's about 1,100 to 1,200 years removed from the time of Moses and when he would have written Exodus. And so that's one problem that critical scholars would point out and say, look, you have this story, and yet the manuscript for it comes from over a millennium after that, so it supposedly happened. However, even if we had a manuscript from the time of Moses or Joshua, they would still use these same criticisms. But today we're going to look at some of the archaeology from Egypt and relating to the Exodus, and we're going to answer some of these criticisms. First of all, the alleged no Egyptian text about or mentioning the Israelites, no Egyptian reference to any events of the Exodus, no archaeological evidence of the events. Now, before we jump into that, I want you to understand that there are basically three views of the Exodus. The first is that it happened in the 15th century BC, and that is if we take the Bible's chronology for these events at face value. The second is the 13th century BC, sometimes called the late date, and that came about as a result of some archaeologists changing their opinions about the conquest of Joshua and connecting that to the Exodus, and then reading some of those numbers as figurative. And then there's the myth. So that today, the myth theory, that is the most prevalent. The Exodus story takes place primarily up here in northern Egypt in the Nile Delta. As you can see, the kingdom of Egypt was quite extensive, but we don't really read about what's going on in the south in the pre-Exodus period or the Exodus period. So it's centered up here, where many archaeological sites have been discovered and excavated. Northern Egypt, the Nile Delta region, the Bible calls this by two names, the land of Ramses and also the land of Goshen. We see that Ramses name in Genesis and then Goshen in Genesis and Exodus. The Ramses name, of course, is going to come up later in Exodus as the name for one of the cities. Ramses, along with Pithom and Heliopolis, are specifically mentioned. Fortresses are referred to later on in the journey, and the Reed Sea, or the Red Sea. Now, if you see on the map here, this is Ramses, or Avaris. We're going to look at that later. Pithom is down here. Heliopolis is down here. So first, we just got to recognize that there's real geography being talked about. There are places that the Bible mentions, that Exodus mentions, that have been discovered and excavated. Now, when did this happen? Because this is important. We can't just pick some artifacts up here and there and look at some cities and say, oh, there's this vague connection, and that means that it's historical. We have to find the right places at the right time. So, thankfully, the Bible does give us some very specific chronological information. 1 Kings 6:1 is a central passage for this, when it says, in the 480th year after the Israelites came out of Egypt, in the fourth year of King Solomon's reign over Israel. Now, generally, there is a consensus among ancient historians and archaeologists that Solomon's fourth year was about 967 BC. There's really very little debate at all about this. So we simply add 479 onto that, and we get about 1446 BC for the Exodus, okay? This could be plus or minus a year or two in there, but approximately. There's a second passage that helps us check this, and that is Judges 11:26 during the time of Jephthah, and it's talking about how the Israelites had lived in the land for about 300 years now. So that's around 1100 BC. Again, we just do some addition, plus 300, plus around 40 years in the wandering, and we come to that same period. Now, if we calibrate this in Egyptian history, which we need to do, then we come into what's called the 18th dynasty. Now, I know there have been various documentaries and books that have come out over the years advocating for a massive revision of Egyptian history and chronology, 300 plus years in many cases. Almost nobody accepts this, right? It's been touted for decades. People have looked into it for a long time. No matter what their theological beliefs or historical biases, almost no one accepts that, and I don't think it's necessary. So we're just going to look at the standard Egyptian chronology and see how the evidence lines up there. Now, the story begins long before the Exodus actually happens, when this family comes to Egypt. Initially Joseph, and then his brothers and the rest of the family. We read in Exodus 1:1, these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. And of course, we have that story starting earlier in Genesis. Now, this trend of people coming from Canaan into Egypt is attested archaeologically. They weren't the only family who made this move. For example, we have a tomb painting from the tomb of Khnumhotep II. This is dated to around 1870 BC, so it's a little before the time of Jacob, but in the same general time period. And as you can see here, this guy with a multicolored tunic, kind of like Joseph, he's coming in with his family, and it continues along, and there are women and children there, pack animals, their possessions. So they're moving into Egypt, they're being led by an Egyptian man. And so we know some of those migrations were occurring. Now, if we go and look at the actual archaeological sites in this land of Goshen Nile Delta region, they've uncovered many artifacts and structures that demonstrate that people from Canaan indeed moved into that Nile Delta region, and specifically to cities like Ramses. For example, at Avaris or Ramses, right? It's got two names. It actually has more than two names because they renamed the city over many centuries. But there are tools and weapons from Canaan that were found. They made things a little bit differently than the Egyptians. Temple architecture and gods from Canaan, again, they had a different religious system. There was some merging or overlapping of the two, but there are distinctions. Sheep remains were discovered in the excavations there, and they were a specific type of long-haired sheep that had been imported, if you will, or taken from Canaan, from the Levant, into Egypt. They were not a native to Egypt. The Egyptians didn't use them. Over 20% of the pottery found at the site is of the Canaanite type. So either they were importing it or they retained their method of making pottery. And that's why we see a lot of it show up at the site. And then there's also this monumental tomb with a statue of an official, an Asiatic official. There's actually more than one of these types of statues that's been discovered, but this one has been made quite famous. Now, how do we know that he's a person from Canaan, or an Asiatic, as the Egyptians call them? It's because of this mushroom-looking hairdo. That's how the Egyptians depicted them in these statues. And so that shows us not only that people from Canaan had moved into that specific area at the time of Jacob and later in Joseph, but also that some had even attained high positions like Joseph did. Something else relating to the migration of people and perhaps shepherds even. Now, we saw the sheep bones, but there's an inscription of the Pharaoh Queen Hatshepsut. So she lived and was in power just a bit before the time of the Exodus. Now, she died before the Exodus occurred. But in one of her inscriptions, she says, "I have raised up what was dismembered, beginning from the time when the Asiatics were in the midst of the Delta in Avaris with vagrants," some translate this as sheep herders, "in their midst, toppling what had been made, they ruled without the sun." So what does this tell us? She's claiming that she fixed things from this early period when it was all in disarray because there were a bunch of these foreigners living in the Nile Delta region in Avaris or Ramses also. Some of them she calls vagrants or sheep herders perhaps. The Egyptians were not fond of sheep or shepherding. If you recall that passage in Exodus where Joseph tells them to say, "We're shepherds," and that's going to help you get your own section of land. You look at Egyptian artwork and you're wondering, where are all the sheep? For some reason, they just weren't into sheep. They ruled without the sun, though. What does that mean? Well, they're not worshiping the sun god Ra. Okay, so again, these people are distinct from your typical Egyptians. Ra was the main god of Egypt at that time. So for somebody to be neglecting him means that they were not looking at things from the Egyptian worldview. One of the huge criticisms, though, that we saw in the beginning was that there's supposedly no mention of any Israelites in Egypt. If that were true, that would definitely be a problem for establishing the historical reliability of the Exodus. But this is not true. So the first thing we're going to start off with, there are these scarab seals that have the name Jacob El or Jacob El that have been found really all over the place. But in particular, we want to note that about 9 of them now have been found at Avaris or Ramses. They date to around 1700 BC, which is about the time of Joseph and Jacob, actually exactly the time of Joseph and Jacob. Some have been found in Canaan also, and some we don't know exactly where they came from on the antiquities market. But first, this demonstrates that name was in use at the time of Jacob. And names, they changed in ancient history. They didn't keep reusing the same names for centuries and centuries like we do today. I don't think that this is necessarily referring to Jacob of the Bible, but it does demonstrate that type of name was in use. And it's not an Egyptian name. It's not even a Canaanite name. It's called an Amorite imperfective name. It originates in the Mesopotamia region where Jacob's family had come over from. Then there is something else called an ostracon. This is a piece of pottery, a broken piece of pottery, with writing on it, sort of used like scratch paper. And one of these that was found at the cemetery of Thebes was inscribed with this name, Yushe, or Jesse. Okay, this is a biblical Hebrew name. The first attestation that we see is from around 1100 BC, maybe, is when he was born, the father of David. So a bit after the Exodus, but it is something that pops up in the Hebrew Bible as a Hebrew name. But there's another artifact, a papyrus, that is even more important in establishing Hebrew names, Israelite names, in Egypt prior to the Exodus, and that is Papyrus Brooklyn. This is from what's called the 13th Dynasty. Again, this is around the time of Joseph, and it lists slaves or servants in a household in Thebes. Generally, this would not be regarded as that interesting of a text. It's a list. It's not a story. It's not a historical document. It's not a poem, etc. But for what we're looking into, it is very important. There are 95 names on the list that remain. As you can see, it's fragmentary. 37 of these names are Semitic. So Hebrew is part of the broader language family of the Semitic languages. But specifically, there are biblical Hebrew names found on this. Some of them are the feminine version of male names that you may be familiar with. And that's because these were household slaves or servants. Usually the Egyptians employed women as the household servants, and then they would have the men do the building or be out in the fields more often. So Menahemma, like Menahem, Asherah, Asher, Shifra, which of course is the name of one of the Hebrew midwives in Exodus chapter 1. It seems to be a variant of Jacob, Akoba. There's a Job name, which this may not be a Hebrew name, but it's definitely not Egyptian, and it comes from the region east of Egypt. We have a feminine name similar to Issachar. We have David in a compound name. We have a name that is not attested in the Hebrew Bible, but it is a Hebrew name, Esebto, and this is related to the name for herb. Then we have Eve's name, Chaya. And then finally, there is this very odd one that seems to be an Egyptian hieroglyphic rendering of Hebrew. So apparently somebody just got named Hebrew. If we look at a list of these, okay, I've put the references, some of the references, where we find the name in the Bible. So we see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Job, probably not a Hebrew name, but so 10 Hebrew names, 10 biblical Hebrew names. None of them are far removed from the Exodus. Some of them are exactly in that pre-Exodus period that pop up in Egypt on Egyptian documents. Okay, these are not written in Hebrew. They're written in Egyptian hieroglyphs, because that was the writing system used at that time. In fact, when these were written, there was no separate writing system for Hebrew yet. That was being developed or yet to be developed. So I would say we do have evidence of Hebrews or Israelites in Egypt prior to the Exodus. We really can't ask for much more than these specific types of names. Well, after they settle there, of course, there's this period of enslavement. And Exodus 1:8 tells us, "Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph." What is this? Well, there is a parallel in Egyptian history that we can look at. So Joseph dies late in the 1600s BC. And not too long after that, this Egyptian dynasty from the south, led by Pharaoh Amos I, came up and he pushed out this dynasty of the Hyksos, they called them, who were ruling in the north, who had essentially taken over Egypt for about a century. And he didn't know any of the rulers that were in the north where Joseph was, because they had no connection to them. In fact, they were their enemies. So he didn't know anything about Joseph. And in fact, he and his dynasty started a policy of enslavement of these Asiatic people. All right, so that's not just Israelites or Hebrews. That's anybody from the east over there in Canaan, in the Canaan region. In fact, it became so common that the word for Asiatic, the Egyptian word Amu, essentially became synonymous with slave in that period. That's exactly what we see happen in the Exodus story. Now, a little bit about evidence of some of the slavery in the pre-Exodus period. This Leningrad papyrus from just before the Exodus, during the time of Pharaoh Thutmose III, who I would say was the Pharaoh right before the Exodus, the Pharaoh who was in power when Moses fled. But it talks about how foreigners or immigrant people were subjected to compulsory or slave labor, and they had to build buildings and they had to work in the fields. Now, the Hebrews are not mentioned, Israelites are not mentioned specifically, but the Egyptians didn't do that. They didn't talk about specific tribes or families of people. They just gave a broad designation based on the general geographic region from which you came. There's artwork that displays this also. The tomb painting in the tomb of the vizier Rekmira shows both Nubian and Semitic slaves making mud bricks, which is something that we read about in Exodus as the Israelites having to do. So if you look at this, all right, these guys, they're collecting the material, they're making it in the wood frame, they're stacking the bricks, they leave them out to dry, then these guys come and collect them, and if we followed it over there, they would be building some buildings. There are Egyptian documents that also talk about this process and even talk about one of the predicaments that the Israelites were put into, and that is when they had straw taken away from their brick-making process and they weren't able to make their quota and they got beat because of it. There's something called the Louvre leather roll, and it comes from a little bit after the time of the Exodus, but it's a general time period, the New Kingdom of Egypt. They still were doing the same types of things in Egypt. And it talks about how they had this quota of bricks there. So 2,000, that's what they had. And then it says how many actually arrived. And they say there's a deficit of 370. And the explanation is they couldn't gather the required amount of straw, and because of that, they were beaten. So exactly the same kinds of things are going on in Egypt that we read about in Exodus. Now, if we go back to some of the cities, Ramses, very important. This is kind of the center of things. It seems like the Israelites are living mostly in and around this city, which was one of the not only major cities of Egypt, but a capital of Egypt at that time. If you can see here, it's built along one of the branches of the Nile River, the Pelusiac branch of the Nile River. You see the sheep out there representing the shepherding fields. But this has been extensively excavated for decades. And the excavators make some very interesting comments on their findings. One of these is enormous storage facilities set up, among them numerous silos, and also a new palatial compound of the 18th dynasty was constructed. Now, we read in Exodus 1:11 that the Israelites were commanded to build storage facilities at the cities of Ramses, Pithom, and Heliopolis. Well, apparently they found this type of structure at Ramses, and again, this is just in the pre-Exodus time period, 18th dynasty, right before where we would place the Exodus. Also, there's a palace there, and this palace was in use into the time of the Exodus Pharaoh, Amenhotep II. We'll look at some of the material associated with him. And then it was abandoned. And it's right on the river. And these are all things that we see in the book of Exodus. Now, the city of Heliopolis, or On, as it is rendered sometimes. This has also had some excavations done, in fact, some fairly recently. We see that there was construction there in the time of Thutmose III, time of Moses, just before the Exodus. An inscription on a stele there talks about how they built a wall around a temple. So we know there was building going on there, right? And presumably this is done by slaves. Slaves, as we saw in some of that artwork and read about. So what's going on with Moses in this pre-Exodus time period? He's born during a time when his people and others like him are enslaved, and they put him in this basket, and then it says the daughter of Pharaoh retrieves him from the Nile. We might know who that was because there really aren't other options available. If we look into Egyptian history, at the time around Moses' birth, there was one child of the Pharaoh who survived past infancy, and it was a daughter. She would have gone by daughter of the king, daughter of the Pharaoh. That would have been her title. And her name was Hatshepsut. She later became a Pharaoh herself. And she would have been quite young at this time, but fully capable of seeing a baby and wanting to rescue it and having her servants do so. But it's not just because of the time overlap and her being the only child and daughter of the Pharaoh. There's also something very strange that happens during the reign of Amenhotep II, who would be the Pharaoh of the Exodus, and that is that her monuments throughout Egypt were systematically destroyed and defaced, and in many cases, where her name was, the cartouche of her name, not only did they scratch it out, but in many cases, Amenhotep II put his name over that, or sometimes his queen's name. For some reason, he didn't like her. He really didn't like her. He tried to erase her from Egyptian history. And there are other instances of this happening in Egyptian history. It's all related to some gross offense against the gods of Egypt, against the kingship of Egypt, against Egypt itself. For example, Akhenaten, you probably know about him. He changed the whole religious system of Egypt drastically and lowered all the rest of the gods, got rid of the priestly system, and so forth. And so later on, when they went back to their normal previous system, they also tried to erase him. Well, if she was this daughter of Pharaoh that rescued Moses from the Nile, then we could understand how the Pharaoh of the Exodus would partially blame her for the events of the Exodus, which brought havoc upon the whole country. Now, why do I think that we can identify this Pharaoh of the Exodus? Obviously, in the book of Exodus, actually in the whole Bible, the Pharaoh of the Exodus is never named, which was a writing convention of the time. You didn't name your enemies, typically. But how can we identify them? Well, there are a lot of criteria that we could look at, and there's a bunch of circumstantial evidence. We've seen one thing with the Hatshepsut connection, but there's something else from the Bible, from Exodus and from Acts. We see that the Exodus Pharaoh, his predecessor, must have reigned for at least 40 years, because Exodus tells us that Moses killed that Egyptian, and he fled the country, and he was gone for 40 years. Then he found out that the Pharaoh had died, and so he was able to come back. Now, there are very few pharaohs in all of Egyptian history who reigned for over 40 years. And around the Exodus time period, there's only one. That's Thutmose III. His son and successor was Amenhotep II. We also see that this pharaoh recently took power. Same thing. That's what happens. Thutmose III, his reign ends around 1450. Amenhotep II comes in. And then the Exodus happens in about 1446. So some interesting things lining up there. This is a statue of Amenhotep II. Before we get into some more about him, there's always a huge question of events of the Exodus, and especially the plagues? Is there any evidence about the plagues of Egypt outside of the Bible? Now, we could ask the question, would the Egyptians actually record an event such as the plagues? It's embarrassing for their country. Their Pharaoh is shown to be powerless. Their gods are shown to be powerless. Much of their country is destroyed. And in the ancient world, if you read through their official historical accounts, you don't find records like that where they talk about the failures and losses of their nation or their kingdom. So we wouldn't expect it in the official Egyptian records, but it could be possible that somebody wrote something about it. There is a very interesting, very unique papyrus that is often referred to as the Dialogue of Ippur and the Lord of All. It's got a lot of names, but Ippur is the author, and that's usually included in the title. What is this? It's a poem. It's a lamentation poem written by this wise man named Ippur. Actually, he seems to have been a bard, and we know that from some other Egyptian inscription that talks about him. But he is complaining about all these terrible things that have happened in Egypt, and he is also critiquing the main god of Egypt, who would be Ra at that time, and probably also the Pharaoh, who is in power. There's dispute over if the All Lord is referring to Ra, the sun god, or the Pharaoh. But he does address both of those characters in the poem. General content, there's a lot of death. There's destruction of pretty much everything. The natural order is disrupted, which for Egyptians was a big thing. They Ma'at was what they called order and truth and just how things were supposed to be. And the gods, as I said, were shown to be powerless. Now, what about poetic lamentations? Can these be historical in the ancient world? Yes, they can. So a couple of examples. We have the Lament for Ur, which talks about the destruction of the city of Ur by the Elamites around 1950 BC. It was a historical event. We know it happened. It's just in poetic form. What about the Book of Lamentations by Jeremiah about the destruction of Jerusalem? That's verified by archaeology also. So yes, a poetic lament can be talking about a historical event. It doesn't disqualify this text as history. But usually, scholars do look at this as unhistorical. They look at it as an allegorical description of the mood of what they call the second intermediate period, or some would go to the first intermediate period. There's only one copy of this papyrus. It dates to approximately the 13th century BC, around 1300 to 1200 BC in that range. Actually, around the time of Ramses II, probably, if you familiar with him. Again, most scholars, though, they say that it was really originally written in about this period of 1850 to 1600 BC. Okay, there's some dispute. And again, it's because they're looking at it from an allegorical perspective. Now, if we got into the details of it, which I'm not going to do that, but the way that it's written, the language in it, some of the words, they indicate that it was composed in the 18th dynasty. This is that general period of before the Exodus, Exodus just after the Exodus, okay? So it falls within that time period. We also have the name Ippur appearing in a text of the time of Hatshepsut and Thutmose III, just before the Exodus. So I don't know if that, it's probably not that Ippur, but the name was in use then, which is, again, it's important. It helps us situate that name in time. Ippur was a real person. We know that from another tomb inscription. It talks about how he was this bard or leader of the singers. But really, what about the content of it? That's what got people connecting it to the Exodus. So some of the content, I put some in quotes and some I just paraphrased. or summarize, but the river is blood. Blood is everywhere. So that's one that stands out. People immediately notice some at least descriptive or literary parallels to the Exodus there. The land is injured because there are all these terrible things happening. The plants are destroyed, the grain is destroyed, etc. Pestilence or plague is throughout the land. In fact, the word that's used there in Egyptian is equivalent to the word that's used for plague or pestilence in the Psalms that are describing the Exodus plagues. Another line talks about herds, all herds, their hearts weep, cattle moan. There's also death and lamentation throughout the land. There's a section that talks about people's hair is falling out. They're in such extreme pain that they wish death upon themselves, maybe connected to the boils. Trees and plants are destroyed. The grain is gone, okay? It doesn't talk about the causes there, but something's happening. Was it locusts? Was it fire, etc.? Children of all different classes have died. That's a big thing, especially that they hone in on children. Another really interesting parallel is day does not dawn on it on the land of Egypt. Remember the days of darkness. And this was very significant for the Egyptians additionally because Ra was the chief god of Egypt at that time. He is the sun god. If he is not showing himself, if he cannot be seen, they think something is very wrong here. Their main god isn't showing up. He's not doing anything. He's not doing his job. And in fact, part of the poem talks about that issue. It uses this idiom, the pilot is not on duty, and it means that the gods are not there. They're not doing their job. They're absent or powerless. In fact, it talks about also how the king is removed, the palace has fallen. So something has happened with the house of Pharaoh. And then finally, it also talks about how the servants take and wear gold, silver, and it lists a bunch of precious stones too, which is exactly what we see with the Israelites at the end of the Exodus. Now, the order in this Ippur poem is not the same as the order of the Egyptian plagues in Exodus, but again, it's a poem. If we looked at the two Psalms which discuss the different Exodus plagues, you will notice they're not in the same order, they're not in a chronological order, and they don't list all of the plagues. So poetry, it's a different genre than historical narrative. But there are a lot of interesting parallels there. What do scholars say about this? Because they have made comments on it. In fact, who is probably the foremost scholar in the world on this papyrus, he talks about how, yes, there are obviously literary parallels that we see between Exodus and Ippur, but they're not describing the same event because neither document is describing history. That's what he says. So he's able to discount the connection because he says neither Exodus nor Ippur are describing historical events. But if they are describing historical events, we see a pretty interesting overlap. Now, connecting to the plagues and the Exodus Pharaoh, we have his son. Thutmose IV was his son who eventually became the next Pharaoh. You saw the Sphinx early on, first slide. You might have been wondering, what's the Sphinx doing there? That's a totally different time period than the Exodus. Right, but the stele that was found between its paws is not. That was put there by Thutmose IV. He supposedly was out hunting in the Giza area, and he laid down by the Sphinx for a nap. And then he had this dream from the god of the Sphinx. And the god told him that he was going to become the next pharaoh. So why would he put a text up like that? Because he needs divine endorsement and legitimacy for his reign. Now, Egyptologists would usually say that that's probably because his older brother died, and so he needed to show that he had a divine blessing as the next pharaoh, and there wouldn't be this power struggle, and maybe another dynasty would come in and try to take over. They're not connecting it to the Exodus at all, though. But if Amenhotep II is the Exodus pharaoh, and Thutmose IV is his son. Then we see, the older brother, whose name was also Amenhotep, he died. He just disappears from Egyptian history. You can read Egyptology textbooks. They would say he died. We don't know how. And so his brother replaces him. If that is a result of the Exodus plagues, this stuff all connects and makes a lot of sense. Now, what about Amenhotep II himself? Well, he was incredibly arrogant, actually one of the most arrogant pharaohs that we know of based on his own texts about himself, which fits pretty well with the profile of the Exodus pharaoh, who is very stubborn and thinks that he is all-powerful and nothing is going to stop his reign or his will. So what are some claims that he makes? He said that he was able to shoot arrows through a copper target a palm thick, okay? This much copper, it's not possible. Rowed a ship faster and farther than 200 Egyptian sailors by himself, okay? Superman, apparently. Single-handedly killed 7 prince warriors of Kadesh. He didn't need his army. He can do it himself. The kings of these other major powers, Babylon, Hittites, Mitanni, came to pay tribute to him. And then he also, in a separate stele, talks about how he conducted the largest slave raid in Egyptian history. Now, he doesn't say the largest slave raid in Egyptian history, but the numbers that he claims are. And we'll look at that in a second. Now, Egyptologists are going to say it's outlandish boasting. Was he compensating for something? Was this just his attitude? He had some issues. He does fit the profile that we would expect of the Exodus pharaoh. But there was also a military decline during his reign, a very severe military decline. His father was one of the most prolific warriors of all Egyptian pharaohs. That we know of, he conducted 17 campaigns, military campaigns. Amenhotep II, he did one at the beginning of his reign, then he did a second after the Exodus, which was just a slave raid, and he never did another campaign. And really, there are no major Egyptian campaigns for about 100 years after this. So something happened where the military was not used, needed to recover, and they focused internally. The Nile Delta Palace was abandoned. I talked about that earlier, but what do the excavators say about this? During the reign of Amenhotep II, they suggest it could have been some type of plague. All right, something bad happened during that time that completely changed Egypt. It caused them to abandon this palace. What about this slave raid to Canaan? Well, this is the second campaign of Amenhotep II. It happened in about 1445 BC, maybe a year after the Exodus. You know, some of the calculations are a little sketchy, but we can say broadly. And what does he claim? He says that he brought back 101,128 prisoners. That is a huge amount back then, okay? Look at other military campaigns for the Egyptians and the captives they took back. The biggest, second biggest one was 5,903. So what's he doing? Again, Egyptologists don't think he actually brought back over 100,000 prisoners from Canaan to be slaves. He seems to be boasting. He seems to be making up for something. If he's the Exodus pharaoh, if this huge slave force left during the Exodus, and then he goes and he runs into Canaan and claims that he brings back all these slaves, then he looks like he's okay. Either he's recovered them or he has gotten some new ones that are going to be better. Does anything about the Exodus come up in Egyptian documents? Well, I mean, we looked at some stuff like the possible Ipuwer papyrus, but later on there is an Egyptian priest historian named Manetho, and he's writing a long time after the Exodus, about 1,100 years after the Exodus, but he does talk about an Exodus of the Israelites, and he obviously had access to sources, more ancient sources that we no longer do. Some of the things that he says: the Egyptians came to a composition with them that they should leave Egypt. So they went away with their whole families and effects, took their journey from Egypt through the wilderness, for Syria. They built a city in that country, which is now called Judea, called it Jerusalem. So we know he's talking about Israelites. And they left Egypt at this time. Now, when does he place this time period? He places it during the reign of a king called Amenophis, which is the Greek rendering of Amenhotep. Now, Josephus quoted this, and Josephus didn't know about a king named Amenhotep, and so he actually thinks that Manetho is just making this up. He's like, this is a fictitious king's name. But we know that there were kings named Amenhotep. In fact, Amenhotep II seems to be the one most likely connected to the Exodus. We talked about the criticism of Egyptian influence. Don't have time to go into detail, but the golden calf could be an Egyptian connection. The Ark of the Covenant certainly is. It's very similar to the architecture of the Shrine of Anubis found in the tomb of King Tut. The tabernacle is, again, similar to the architecture of the Pharaoh's traveling tent. The early Hebrew writing system is based off of Egyptian hieroglyphs. There are many, many Egyptian words and names in the Torah, telling us that whoever wrote that, Moses, would have known Egyptian. Geography, again, geography is real. Just briefly, I'll mention, in Exodus 14:2, it talks about these four locations when they're about to escape Egypt. Pi-Hahiroth, Migdal, Baal-Zephon, and the sea. So Pi-Hahiroth, that is Akkadian, means mouth of the canal. So the Egyptians had these canals connecting these lakes, and they went into the Mediterranean. Then we have Migdal. That was a loan word from Canaanite into Egyptian. It was used for fortress. There were fortresses all along this main road here. That's why it talks about how God did not lead them along the way of the Philistines, lest they see war. If they went that way, they were going to run into all these Egyptian military fortresses. Baal-Zephon. This is associated with the site here, Tel Defenna, where they had a temple to this god. And then the sea, or the Sea of Reeds. And so we have these reed lakes all along here, right? I couldn't tell you exactly where they crossed. I don't think anybody could, but it was probably right in this area based on those geographical markers. These are things that are talked about in ancient Egyptian texts, including the reeds area, the Sea of Reeds area, or the reed lakes areas. This is some Egyptian artwork from the New Kingdom showing that. Here's a drawing of it, the actual carving. You can see some of the reeds and the lake there. Now, to wrap up, what happened after they left Egypt? Well, obviously they were wandering around. And this is, again, a major criticism. There's no evidence for the wandering. And yet, there is. It's just not archaeological sites in the Sinai, because nomads don't leave archaeological traces like that from 3,400 years earlier. But on an Egyptian temple in Sudan, at a place called Soleb, which was part of Egypt at that time, there was a temple of Amenhotep III. He was in power during the end of the wandering period, the beginning of the conquest. And like many other Egyptian kings, he listed his supposed conquests or some of the people that he had subjugated on these various lists, walls and columns. So on some of these columns and on the wall in the temple, there were these lists. On one of the sections was a list of some nomad groups who the Egyptians called Shasu. That was their name for it. And one section, it actually talks about nomads who are associated with various different gods or leaders. And one of those name rings has the Nomads of Yahweh. So this is from 1400 BC. This is the earliest mention of Yahweh that's ever been found yet. And it comes at a time of the wandering period. Geographically, it places these Nomads of Yahweh in the area east of Egypt, approximately Moab, Edom, possibly Canaan, where the Israelites would have been during the late wandering period. Of course, they were wandering. They were nomads at that time. Numbers 16:41 calls the Israelites the people of Yahweh. They're the only people that worship Yahweh in the ancient world. It's very easy to identify them. So it tells us that the Egyptians were familiar with Yahweh. they knew about the people who worshiped Yahweh. They even knew that they had become wanderers after they left Egypt. And then they show up in Canaan eventually, which again is attested by the Egyptians on the Merneptah Stele, where down here at the bottom, it talks about Israel as the main group of people in this land of Canaan in the 13th century BC. So to sum it up, we have evidence in Egypt of Semites or Asiatics. We have Hebrew names. We have the slavery and the mud bricks. We possibly have this Egyptian poetic account of the plagues. The Nile Delta Palace is abandoned. This possible association with Hatshepsut, the daughter of Pharaoh, who saved Moses. Amenhotep II, he goes in and supposedly takes back all these slaves, claims that. There's a decline of the military. His son dies, and the next son is the one who becomes the king. And then the wandering, we do have archaeological evidence of this in the Egyptians themselves, the Pharaoh even, talking about the nomads of Yahweh. And so, like Peter says in 1 Peter 3:15, we should always be ready to make a defense for what we believe. And we do have evidence from archaeology, from ancient history, for all different periods of the Bible. And this is just one sample, one very debated sample. But if we have that for the Exodus, I can assure you we have it for many other periods as well.